Lost and Sound is proudly sponsored by Audio Technica. Audio Technica are a global but still family-run company that make headphones, turntables, cartridges, microphones, studio quality, yet affordable products, because they believe that high-quality audio should be accessible to all. And I'm speaking to you right now wearing their M50X headphones. They're for the studio, they're for every day. I speak to all my guests wearing these headphones. I wear them on the move, and that's often how I listen. But whatever way you like to listen, head on over to audiotechnica.com to check out all of their range of stuff. Welcome to Lost and Sound. I'm Paul Hamford. I'm your host. I'm a writer and author based in Berlin, where I'm speaking to you now from. And this is the show where each episode I have conversations with the musical innovators, the outsiders, the mavericks, the artists that do their own unique thing, and we talk about life and the things that inspire us to make the things that we make. Previous guests have included Peaches, Suzanne Chiani, Jim O'Rourke, Chili Gonzalez, Letitia Sadier, Ghost Poet, Cozy Fanny Tutti, Baxter Jury, Nastia, Sleaford Mods, Nightmares on Wax, and First and More. And today, you're going to hear a conversation I had with Richie Culver. My book, Coming to Berlin, is available now on Velocity Press or in specialist bookshops. And yes, well, we're here. It's a beautiful sunny day in Berlin where I'm speaking to you from. I'm in Hasenheide Park. And this interview is very, very fresh. This is so fresh that if you got it from a chill cabinet in a supermarket and you left it on a table, it'd still be all right. It wouldn't give you like a dodgy belly or anything. I met up with the British visual and audio artist Richie Culver earlier on today. I'm speaking to you the same day, and I'm going to be putting this out so long as I don't get a bit too weary with all of the kind of like putting it out stuff. If I manage to do that in the next couple of hours and you're listening to it, this episode, the day it's come out, then you're listening to an interview that was done the very, very same day. And yeah, so I met up with Richie early afternoon today. He was in town. He lives in London, but he was in town. He has an exhibition opening this Friday in Berlin, and we got into a real chat. His debut album, I Was Born by the Sea, came out recently, and he'll soon present a remix album version of it featuring contributions by Space Africa, Rainy Miller, and so more. He is still perhaps mostly known more for his visual work, but that is the music has always been something, as we have this talk, that has been kind of quite an important part of his life, a very, very important part of his life. Richie's story to where he is today is a long one. Growing up on the outskirts of the northern English city of Hull, he spent his formative years reckoning with the gravitational pull of his hometown, racked with anxiety, aimlessness, and low self-esteem. A massive shift occurred when a painting of his appeared in a group exhibition at the Tate Modern. A little while later, during lockdown, a piece he made called Did You Come Yet went viral online and developed into conceptual work with the experimental rapper and choreographer Black Hayne. His music, to me, has echoes of another Hull export, Throbbing Gristle, and it mixes experimental electronics with spoken word. And it also reminds me a little bit too, it feels like it's come out of the same pandemic lockdown era explosion of creativity out of the north of England that like Black Hayne came out of, and Space Africa, artists like that are playing electronic music quite often without beats, with spoken words, with real experimentation and a sort of real grit, dark humor, social comment. So yeah, we had this face-to-face conversation, and the conversation covers frank and honest stuff about addiction. Richie himself is 8 years sober. We cover social media. We cover things like about being present, about his creative process. We talk about Nan Goldin. We talk about lots of things. It was a really enjoyed meeting Richie. Had a really nice chat with him, and this is what happened. You're here prepping for an exhibition.
Yeah.
And I'm speaking to you predominantly about the audio work, although I love all of your work. It's just that's the field that I know.
Yeah,
you know, as someone that kind of does work in various different mediums and stuff like that, is there like an essence at the end of the day that is the same between all of the different platforms that you work on? You know, does it come from the same... Is there sort of a creative essence behind the sort of skill sets?
I think that's the goal. The goal for me is to have my music and my visual stuff live harmoniously under the same umbrella. In my own head, there's clashing at the moment of... I work with predominantly words, text in my visual stuff, and spoken word, and you know, in my music work. So I'm starting to reduce the text in my visual stuff to let them everything live more harmoniously. If
right.
That makes sense.
Yeah, no, definitely. Do you feel like this sort of is that sort of part of like a kind of like equilibrium thing? Do you think? Do you kind of get to points of your work where you take a stop and reflect on it, or is it always like a kind of constant momentum of just doing stuff?
It's more of, I like to look at other people, you know, my forebearers, those that come before me and see, and there's not that many, you know, that painters that have done the music thing, you know, I'm not going to say right, you know, but there just isn't. It's like, it feels like I'm going into a bit of a realm on my own with the kind of visual stuff I do and then the music. But, you know, I've looked at the likes of Mark Leckie, who does it in my eyes perfectly. His visual output and his music stuff just sits perfectly together. It's like he creates this world. Wolfgang Tillmans does it, you know. Throbbing Gristle, Genesis Peorage did it absolutely perfectly. So they're the three people that I look at. And then when I'm under my own umbrella, I just feel like I need to head in a more conceptual route with regards to my visual work, reduce the words, and then I'll have what feels like the final package to go on with. And I've kind of done that with, I've recently been painting as a text-based artist. Somebody basically said to me, what would you like on your tombstone when, you know, when my time comes or whatever? And I said, I would like born at the top and died at the bottom and nothing else. And then from that grew some paintings in which I wrote born at the top of the canvas and died at the bottom. And within that work, I feel like I'd finally said everything I ever wanted to say within my text-based paintings. Mm-hmm. It's like, I never imagined that there would be like a terminus like that, where it's like, okay, there I am. I don't know what else to say now, given how vast the English language is, which I work within. So I will probably just paint within that variation for a while. And that, of course, sits better with my music. It's saying less within my visual stuff and then going into narratives within my audio stuff.
So interesting that, like, that kind of moment came to you for a tombstone, you know, which is almost like a kind of a form of written art anyway, isn't it?
No, absolutely. I mean, that has actually been, some artists have done the tombstone things, which, you know, I would have probably had an investigation into had they not. I mean, everything's been done right, pretty much. All the good band names have been taken and et cetera, et cetera. So as long as that doesn't, I can't really let that, you know, as long as artists don't let that put them off. But yeah, it was when I exhibited a full exhibition of the Born Died, and they ended up kind of looking like hospital beds / tombstones, because it's just, I literally just write the word "born" at the top, "died" at the bottom, in a spray can on the blank canvas. So it's the very minimal works and kind of reductionism. But they say more than any of the other works that I've done, but while saying less at the same time, and almost it gets to a point where people ask about the works, and you know, I love to critique works and I love to speak about my work, and it's something they enjoy. But with those works, it feels like you're almost insulting the viewer's intelligence. To okay, let's break down life. And kind of life or death or everything in between. So I'm struggling slightly with them, which I enjoy, you know, when my own work challenges me, because I'm not quite sure whether to speak about them or not. And I'm not sure what's the more powerful version.
Yeah, it's interesting, that idea, isn't it? Like, from the outside, I think sometimes people view like artists as being kind of having a completeness about them, and they go and do their work. But yeah. Do you feel it is more of like an ongoing process of sort of figuring stuff out about yourself, or figuring out what the world, what you're connecting with at the moment?
Yeah. I think I'm in a new phase now, whether I'm either concentrating on my music or concentrating on my when I put one down, the other one's always there, and I'm very lucky in that way. It's, of course, the music thing is relatively new, but releasing, you know, kind of since 2001. So it's, I feel like I'm in my infancy, you know, within it, even though I'm well schooled in music and the scene and everything else. But it's, yeah, feels new and fresh, whereas the visual thing is, feels slightly older.
I think one of the things that was really interesting as well was, I read that one of your first pieces was part of a group exhibition at Tate.
Yeah.
As well. And you're a self-trained artist. You didn't kind of go, you know, didn't go to like art school. You were sort of saying that art wasn't a big factor in your life when you were growing up. Did you feel like going into the, did you feel like this was like a different world that you were going into at the time?
I'll start at the top, basically, or at the bottom.
Yeah.
I left school and I got a job making caravans in a caravan factory at sort of like 15, 16. I remember, and I'd also started raving in and around that kind of time, maybe slightly before, like happy hardcore and trance, and kind of, this is like 94, 95.
I was very similar, like that was kind of a period where there was a lot of like manor house, abandoned old manor house raves, and you know, follow a van down a dirt track somewhere.
Yeah, all of that. There was, I don't know, it just felt really natural. It didn't feel like it was like, oh my God, you know, this is, I'd missed the main boom basically in the late 80s, you know, I was too young, but I caught when club culture started happening basically. That was, but there was also, I was from the outskirts of Hull, so there was lots of like, you know, people was into the happy hardcore, really hard sort of trance kind of rave stuff. But anyway, I was aware of all that. I started going to, there was a rave in Hull called Deja Vu, which was primarily, it was house music basically. It was when like a DJ would kind of like do the full set. It'd sort of start off kind of light and then end up heavy. Think kind of like Cream and there was the DIY thing in Nottingham, and Leeds had Hard Times. We had a thing called Deja Vu, and I would go to these. I would go every week, you know, and then at after parties, when they would go to sort of after parties like in surrounding towns, and we drove all the way from Leeds once from Hull to someone's after party who visited Hull from Leeds, and I was at the after party kind of doing what you do, and there was an Anne Golden book on the table. This person was a student, and it was a bunch of students, and I picked it up, and you know, I was flicking through this Anne Golden book, and I was, you know, it was like, you know, people get paid for this, you know, is this for books of photographs? And then someone starts telling me the story, and I recognize a lot of these images just from my own personal experience in life from where I'm from. A lot of the, she captured visions that I related to, and I instantly had that moment of, I could do this. Do you know, I know these kinds of people. And so I guess that was my first, you know, thing that opened my eyes to, wow, you know, this is, people get, this is a career path, this is a career choice, and, you know, I understand it. It was gritty, it was, and then I saw a Larry Clark book shortly after, and Throbbing Gristle stuff, through there, Throbbing Gristle poster, and it was just kind of like, they're from, you know, they're from Hull, and da-da-da, and, or not from Hull, but, you know, kind of formed in Hull. So all of a sudden, it was like tick, 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 and things started feeling possible and beyond the caravan factory that I was in. So that was when the first kind of seed happened, as in, you know, art is the thing. Because I literally didn't know any... Damien Hirst and those guys was big at the time, but it was, yeah, nothing crossed my, maybe like laying in bed, you know, so you stick to Channel 4 on a Friday night at 1 a.m. and here we are at the Tate Modern, and you know, that's about the only access that I saw.
Did you, what were your sort of first sort of steps into making your own art?
Well, DJing was first, and messing around with music production and stuff like that. There was guys like the Doncaster Warehouse people. There was like M Zone and all these kind of like a bunch of local kind of celebrity underground kind of like DJs. They didn't really make it out of Yorkshire, you know, but there was all kind of like the residents. Steve Kobe, actually, from Vila Brasilia, you know, was someone, I didn't realise he was in Vila Brasilia at the time, but I'd seen him DJ a few times. Vila Brasilia came a little bit later for me, but it was DJing and music production was my first creative outputs. Like, got my first decks when I was like 12, 13, so it's funny that it's come full circle.
DJing's kind of, and music production is something that, like, I mean, in my view, at least, I might be completely wrong, is kind of, there's a lot of access points to it, like from you know, people from all walks of life can do, whereas like art and the fine art world, there's so many sort of barriers, aren't there, to kind of get your work across. You know, I remember like I didn't do art school, even though I wanted to, because I remember like just looking at the sort of, the way you even apply for it in England, you have to go through like a sort of different method of applying, like on the forms and stuff like that. Yeah. And then people kind of come out of, friends that went to art school were always kind of worried that they were on a course that wasn't going to get their work recognised, you know, unless you're at St Martin's or Goldsmiths or something like that.
Yeah.
I mean, what were your sort of, did you feel like a bit intimidated initially when you started putting your artwork out there or kind of going for it?
I guess this kind of like fast forwards a little bit to the Tate Modern. Somebody, I'd started making collages, you know, I started taking the photographs that I mentioned earlier. It felt a little bit, you know, Nan Goldin did it from a voyeur, she did it from a documentarian kind of, I don't think she was part of the worlds that she photographed. I started photographing things and it was too close to home, so I stopped, but I kept the photographs and then I started adding text on them and stuff. So I was basically making collage, again, totally unaware of William Burroughs kind of stuff that he did and things that it was similar to. I was just doing it from a really naive, honest kind of place. Fast forward many years, someone came to my house, saw them. They was like, you know, you should exhibit these, you know, you should do something with them. And they told me about the Tate Modern. They was doing a thing for outside artists. Again, didn't mean anything to me what that was. I was drinking fairly heavily at the time and using, so it kind of, I fit under the outsider umbrella, just my life at the time. So I put one of the works in, it got accepted, and then there was like a green light that was like, you need to like go at this now.
Right.
So it was.
This is like an opportunity. This is like the.
Yeah. Of course, the fact that it was the Tate Modern. It's not like it was in it. It was in the Turbine Hall, and it was like there was this little section. It wasn't like, you know, I'm not part of the collection or anything, but it was just like, this is something to build off. Yeah. You know, considering there was nothing to build off really, and so I continued to make work. I started painting, started doing art. Just making work in the rawest form, using text, which has always kind of like been there. And yeah, that was kind of like the moment, I guess.
Yeah. And was that like a never look back moment, or is it a constant sort of thing? You know, do you wake up feeling like an artist, or do you wake up sort of going, I'm Richie, oh, what am I doing today?
I definitely wake up feeling like an artist, unfortunately. It'll be the death of me, you know. It's kind of, you know, I have this ability to just like push people away, and kind of, I have three kids and a very normal life in London, but you know, unfortunately, one's head is just very unforgiving when it comes to ideas and being there but not being there. You know, even when my phone's down and I'm, you know, it's like, oh, just stop, just let me be in the moment and just not obsessing about words. And yeah,
it's, I mean, in my version of it, because I'm like a writer as well, and used to be a musician, and I feel that like it. The worst side for me of being an artistic person is just I can be really selfish sometimes. You know, I don't mean to be. I think I'm a nice person. Then I'll realize something after the event, you know, where I'm just not taking into account someone's feelings about something really obvious.
I relate to that on a massive scale. Mm. It's even worse when you kind of like watch these Miles Davis documentaries, and when it's just like, wow, you see the greats, super selfish. It's like, so I guess you have to be kind of. But I find out that the most beautiful things career wise happen to me though when I'm not obsessing and I'm just getting on with my life. And then all of a sudden, you're almost presented with something, an opportunity, and that. But while I'm there, just kind of like pressing the refresh button in my head every fucking 5 minutes. It's like, come on, what? Come on, someone, like, your opportunities, come on. Because it's like with the music thing and the visual thing, I always think that everything's going to be my last, you know, like this show's going to be my last, it's not going to sell, this record's going to be my last, you know, everything's like this last chance saloon thing. Yeah.
Yeah. And does that make the work better, do you think? Do you thinking that, okay, this might be the last thing I do?
Well, I've halved it now with the music. Do you know what I'm saying? If it is my last visual show. I'm kind of like, I'm splitting my options. I really don't know. You know, it's I've heard other artists say the same thing, which is not nice, but it's soothing.
Soothing, yeah. And I think it's interesting what you're saying about the Miles Davis thing as well, because I definitely think, like, when I was growing up in the 90s, I think it's a little bit different now, but there was a lot of... I felt that it was a sort of myth that was sort of pushed on people, the kind of rock and roll myth, you know, that was really destructive, I think.
It's interesting you should say this, actually. I'm actually at the Royal College at the moment doing a master's. Mm. You know, you mentioned the self-taught thing. During lockdown, they changed at the RCA the master's from, I think it was a 3-year to a 1-year. Mm. I saw that and everyone was complaining about it, and everyone that was at the RCA, all my friends, a lot that are there was complaining. I was like, oh my God, this is perfect for me. So I applied and got on. I got in, so I'm about to finish in 2 weeks.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you. But I now have my eyes on a PhD because I didn't do the BA, so it's like, I think I'd like to continue in this world. And my question for the PhD would be, I'm 8 years sober and clean.
Congratulations.
So I'm in recovery. And my question is exactly what you just said, the myth of the mind-altering substances and how that affects or defects an artist's practice. Me, when I was using and drinking, I couldn't even get to the studio. You know, I was just lying in bed in the myth, you know, of the struggling artist kind of, you know, I've sobered up and my career excelled. Of course, this is, you know, depending where you go in the world, this and mental health at the moment and medication and prescriptions, you know, it's a really broad subject, but it's something that I'm looking into.
It's really interesting, isn't it? And thank you for saying about, you know, telling me about 8 years. So congratulations on 8 years sober as well.
Thanks.
And I think this myth that is kind of sort of like when I was young, it was like all about like kind of copying Jim Morrison or whoever else, you know, just like this sort of glamour of it as well. But like you were saying as well earlier on, like when you were saying, when you don't stress out about the work, that's when it sort of happens.
Yeah.
It's weird, isn't it? It's like, it's almost like if you're stressing about something or more pressure you put yourself under, the less you can move around you or see around you.
Yeah. As soon as I'll speak for myself, as soon as I kind of let go and kind of do things for others and kind of be a better dad, be a better partner, you kind of, you know, be a better person, you know, in the street and just kind of, I don't know, just be, it just seems to work that way. I've always kind of known it, that's how it works. But, you know, as an artist, there's just got this selfish streak and this drive and this determination of competition that no one else is in competition with me, but in my head is I just have this
yeah.
I'm sure nobody cares, and that I'm just like, oh, gotta do this, gotta do that, got yeah.
I mean, you're quite known for your rather than competition, you're quite known for your collaborations as well.
Yeah,
like, I love the stuff you do with Black Hane.
Yeah.
How did that come about?
Right, it was at the beginning of lockdown. It was actually on Humber Street Gallery in Hull, their Instagram feed. They posted, you know, this movement piece, and I was just like, instantly, I was just like, who's this? You know, and he was doing a movement piece on the bridge, these really jerky kind of Ian Curtis kind of moves. But if you know what, with Black Hane's visual, how he is and, you know, how
it's
he looks.
Quite imposing figure, isn't he?
Yeah. And instantly I was like, you know, I don't know. It was my thing. I was just like, oh, okay. Went down the worm. I wasn't sure whether it was art or I wasn't sure what it was. It challenged me. And then there was spoken word on top and I was like, oh my God, he's... And then I went down the wormhole further and I found that he rapped. You know, there was one track at the time called Moors, Out on the Moors. And it was a rap track. And I was like, instantly, it was like, this guy's is a ready-made icon, you know. So I gathered the courage to, after a while, to approach him. Because I still wasn't sure if he was a rap, but what he was doing. I just knew that, so I reached out and, you know, I was like, I have this painting, would you be up for doing a visual and a sound piece in reaction to this painting? And we did it. Will and I released, we started a label to release it on. The piece was amazing. This was at my entrance point with Tailored Communications as well. But I didn't know at the time that this was kind of like, I guess, you know, like Rainey Miller then came on my radar, who's, you know, Space Africa. And it felt like it was a really kind of like special time in Manchester, it was, you know, all the north of England, where artists was kind of like coming together during lockdown. And then, of course, lockdown finished and, you know, Black Hane's career has since like gone to where I thought he would go. You know, he's got that icon kind of thing about him.
Definitely. I saw him on stage at an owl, actually, with Space Africa.
That was
super powerful, really.
Yeah.
Really good and stuff. And this was the track you talked, this was like the Did You Come Yet?
Yeah. That was it was a painting. It was right at the beginning of lockdown. It was when I'd kind of, NFTs started poking their heads up. And I was like, I'm not down with that. Locked out. So let's look at this. The world's going to end. There's this disease in the world that, you know, it's like, but Instagram's going crazy and kind of like, it was a really good time as a visual artist. And I thought, right, I'm not going to do those NFTs, but I'm going to adapt my style to a painting style that is instantly recognizable. And you can just view it and read like a tweet almost. So I started painting just text, just like one hit. And the first one that I did was Did You Come Yet, which was a reference to people posting on social media during lockdown and kind of, and even my own kind of, you know, posting on social media. So that's basically what that piece was about. And the piece went, I'm not going to say viral, but it got posted a lot. And the comment section was 90%. You know, dislike. So then I made a book of the comments. I just made a book called Did You Come Yet? And then it was the painting on the front and then all the comments inside. It's like 500 pages or something, just kind of gathering, screen grabbing the comments from all these various pages that had reposted it. And off the back of that, I was like, maybe I could make an audio version of this. I destroyed the painting. So we've got the book. And then we got the record, and then that was that. It was kind of like a conceptual work specifically for, you know, lockdown, as my own interpretation of it, and also a shedding of skin, as in I'm just going to paint like this now.
Yeah,
because the world's going to end, and I don't think there'll be any exhibitions again. So it's like, here's my words or tweets or, you know, yeah.
A bit like the kind of like last work you do kind of thing.
A little bit.
Earlier on.
Yeah, yeah.
It's interesting, like, you know, and also like, sort of, this sort of dialogue about social media and stuff. And as an artist, it's sort of like, most people use social media in some form or another, but as an artist, it's become like a kind of a necessity, really.
Yeah.
You know? And how do you feel about that? You know, is it a love-hate thing or do you...
It's funny because I watch... you know, I'll speak specifically about the visual stuff here because, I mean, I think it covers everything, but I've seen visual artists, you know, with, you know, like literally go from an outsider artist that's just painting and posting the photographs on Instagram to being with Pace Gallery or kind of, you know, this, and it's all happening via Insta. Everyone gets spotted or the work gets noticed usually now, I'd say 99% of the time. On Instagram. I kind of know that because I've had my degree show at the RCA in 2 weeks. And it's, you know, I think the days of being spotted at your degree show have gone. I think anyone that's looking or is already aware of you and is, you know, either watching you without liking or, you know, kind of dormant in, or they've approached you. So social media as a tool for that, in that respect, is priceless.
Yeah, it democratizes things to a degree if it means you don't have to go to a school to do.
Yeah, absolutely. It cuts out the middleman in many ways as well, and it just creates opportunity, I guess.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
It's very addictive, of course. You know, phones in general, and you know, I don't show my kids. My kids don't have phones, and they probably won't for as long as. We can go without showing them it. I just realise how I react to it, you know, kind of pointlessly scrolling. It's like a crack pipe in my pocket.
It is. Someone said once it's the crack cocaine of technology.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's real. And it fries my brain. So heaven forbid, you know, one of my little kids will be like having it for as long as we can.
How old are your kids? You're three.
1, 3, and 5.
Right.
Yeah. So they're really young. So we're not there yet where they're wanting to play Call of Duty on us. I'm sure it's coming. But yeah, this is, you know, everything in moderation, I guess.
Yeah. And the album, I Was Born by the Sea.
Yeah.
I've been listening to it a lot over the last few weeks. And again, yeah, you mentioned like about Throbbing Gristle earlier on, and I can sort of feel a little bit of Throbbing Gristle in there. You know, in the way that work can kind of be absorbed and then transformed into someone artist's own thing.
Yeah.
And I was really interested about sort of what your methods for making the music were. Like, you know, is it quite a kind of spontaneous thing for you, or is it quite sort of studied and slow?
It's completely spontaneous. It's like, I think I've outgrown the outsider tag in my visual work. It's like, I'm no longer an outsider artist. That's kind of, but within my music work, I'm happy with that tag. You know, I'm definitely not trained or anything like that. Regarding the work, it's kind of using hardware, kind of like my painting. You know, it's like minimalism and reductionism at the core of it, and using instruments and hardware to the best of my ability, but to the least of theirs.
The sweet spot where
just you know, it's always, I was working with an OP1, the Teenage Engineering, and it was just so vast what it could do and what it couldn't do, and I've been messing around with it for ages, and then I just used it to its least, you know, I guess a DIY approach with, it's quite technical hardware, and I don't really use kind of computer music and software and whatnot. Most of it is done on guitars, kind of violins, found violins, banging stuff on the U-Bahn in the track It's Hard to Get to Know You. I went on the U-Bahn when I came visiting Berlin once, and I was, you know, it was quite early in the morning, around the times when I used to score back in the day when I was living here, and I was like, recorded a lot of the dealers and the users' kind of conversations when there was, because there's nobody down there at like 5-6 a.m. apart from the addicts. So yeah, just it's kind of like using autobiographical ways to make music, like going to old places and kind of using modern technology to record things that have, but in an autobiographical kind of account, and then just crushing it up to the point where it's unrecognizable, and then just stamping on things, really. And then the spoken word stuff is, I'd actually, I remember sending Melissa at Tailored, like this after the Black Hand thing. After the Black Hand thing, it was almost like, I'm going to start making music again. You know, I think a lot of those Manchester artists kind of inspired me. It felt like this, it was the start of something. And the White Hotel, and I was just watching it all. It was during lockdown, but as things started to pick up again, it was like, I've got more to say, basically. A lot of the stuff that I can't really say in my paintings, because it's just not necessary. And it's all really obvious, you know. I mean, I'm sure I'm not the first person to make a record about the hometown, you know, and getting out of it, you know, Tracy Chapman. And, you know, but it was just important for me as a starting point that that's where I started. But anyway, I sent Melissa this record, and it didn't have any vocals on it. Again, going back to the umbrella thing, I was like, right, the music that I'm going to do, if this is all text in my visual stuff, I'm going to do music that's just in electronic. But it just didn't feel legit. You know, it was just like, I felt like I was kidding myself, like, and possibly kidding other people. So then I went back to the drawing board and started making different tracks and putting spoken word down, and the spoken word came really easily because I've always wrote poetry and messed with language and it just came really easily.
Yeah. There's a lot of humour as well in your work, and it's sort of, there's something about, like, I mean, I don't know if you had this when you lived in Berlin as well, but like, being English, we don't really, it's kind of a bit awkward and weird being, you know, like sort of what we represent sometimes and stuff, but we do have humour, you know,
yeah,
and sometimes I sort of feel like we use humor in a way where like it's really English, where it's like it's almost like a form of I don't know what, resistance or something like that, you know. Do you find like humor's been kind of important for your life to kind of explain things or get through situations or?
Yeah, the humor thing is just is I can track it back to school, you know, before any of the, I guess the humor thing was like a free pass through school.
Mm.
You know, it was, you know, if you can look a certain way and be relatively funny, then life is easier. And if you're good at football or sport, then great as well. So I've always been aware of it as a crutch. So then when I started making work, it came quite obvious.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I can relate. I mean, I definitely found like I wasn't athletic and I wasn't like sort of conventionally smart at school.
Yeah.
And so to stop being bullied or to not be bullied or whatever, like, I found like if I swore at a teacher in a funny voice,
then
kids would just leave me alone for a little while.
Yeah.
And I had to
kind of
top it up after a while. Like, you tell a teacher to fuck off 1 month, then about a month later, I have to do something else now to keep them away.
Yeah, it's like survival kind of tactic, isn't it?
Definitely. How is it being back in Berlin for you?
I always love it here. You know, it's filled with all kinds of, you know, it's hard to be anywhere else in the world, and especially on a Sunday, for instance, just knowing what's going on here. I've always been drawn to Berlin for very, it's just like a big village, isn't it? It's like a big village that feels very free. And of course, people are going to say it's changing, and you know, it's changed since I was here, and when I was here, people said it had changed from before. But yeah, it always feels good. It always feels like things are possible. It always feels like things are happening. I just love, you know, the mindset regarding music and electronic music, and you know, it's kind of the only place to be, really.
You were a bit of a Bergheim guy, were you?
Yeah. I went on the weekend.
Yeah.
Still kind of, you know, enjoy to go. But I went every. Will, who I started Participant Records with, who actually used to work for Tailored, we met in Bergheim. So it's we was in Bergheim, literally just, you know, kind of like aimlessly talking about, you know, let's either start a band or a label, and and then of course, you know, nothing ever happens. But yeah, we kind of did, sort of like 10 years later or 8 years later or whatever. So it's not all just idle chat in there, kind of like.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it'd be interesting to sort of collect all of the different things that have kind of come out of there. Just if you know.
Can you imagine? Babies.
Yeah. Yeah, no, totally. Yeah.
Bands, you know, yeah. DJ names, kind of. Yeah, I know. I mean, that's a really interesting. I guess there's no answer to it, but it's an interesting. I wonder if you could do a PhD on that.
Yeah. Or sort of create some kind of online platform where people put their own experiences.
Yeah.
And stuff like that,
what did you start? What ideas did you mention in a club and actually came through?
Yeah. And like in the song Pigeon Flesh, there's this line: at this point in your life, you're exactly where you're meant to be.
Yeah.
Do you feel at this point in your life you're exactly where you're meant to be?
Yeah, I mean, that kind of links into everything, kind of the philosophy in and around the steps in recovery. I don't know if there's like it's a 12-step program when you're in AA and NA, but the. Yeah, I'm not going to get too philosophical about it. It has to be that way, really, you know. Mm. Yeah, yes.
Yes.
You know, I'm sat here with you now, kind of like doing this. That's usually one that kind of, times when I've been trying to get sober in the past or speaking to someone else that's kind of like trying to do the same thing, it's, and you just like, you can't sleep on a night, and you know, you're wondering what's going to happen tomorrow. And you know, I think it's a good mantra for those kind of moments. You know, that helped me personally when it was like, okay, this is where I am. I'm like 6 days sober. Mm. You know, everything's gone to shit. But you know, this is where I'm, this is my reality at the moment, and you know, I have to be cool with that. It's hard to, you know, to put it into everyday life. It doesn't always make sense.
Yeah.
Usually, kind of when something challenging is happening.
Is there something to do with living in, like, being present in the moment?
Yeah. It's exactly that. Which is, you know, becoming more and more difficult with social media and phones kind of actually being in the moment. But that's basically what that song was about, you know. I didn't, you know, get my phone out to video the dog eating the pigeon, you know. I stood in silence and witnessed the event and just kind of watched this kind of brutality kind of take place, and didn't share it with anyone, and just kind of like didn't intervene, just kind of, it was just me and God and the two animals.
Yeah. Kind of thing. It's almost like we need a witness.
At the moment, yeah. Like, oh my, you know, stick that on my story, you know.
Yeah,
like,
it happened.
Yeah.
I'm guilty of that. I'm really guilty of that. In about an hour, I'll probably do a little story about this, you know.
But
it's weird, isn't it? You know.
That's exactly what that track was about. Yeah, kind of being in. I often say that to my partner, and she always wants to, like, with three kids, she's always like, come on, get this photo, you know. It's always like, sometimes I was like, no, this one's just between us and God, you know, like, while Libby's going down a slide or something.
Yeah, definitely. I wonder if they'll do, like, some kind of, like, remake of, like, It's a Wonderful Life, or one of those films where someone's, like, brought up in heaven and they have to kind of look back on their life, and there's no social media of it. Maybe you don't get let in.
Yeah, exactly. There's no proof.
Yeah. And what does home mean for you?
Home.
Because you've moved around quite a bit, and, you know, and...
Yeah. Home is London. Home is London. I've spoken about this a lot recently because I think if I was single and didn't, you know, if circumstances was different, I would probably move back here. And it's a great place to be single and just be work obsessed. But it's very difficult, you know, with a partner and three kids to come somewhere else basically and try and create a community. You know, it's doable, of course it's doable, but I've lived in London for 20 years, so my community, whether I like it or not, is in London. You know, the person in the shop that I wave to every day, the guy next door but four that I sometimes speak to, you know, sort of, it's just, you can't really deny that. So that's, London is home. My heart is Northern, you know, but I think like a Southerner, you know, I'm a Londoner in my head.
Yeah,
if that makes sense.
I mean, I have an impression of how it is related to my experience, but you know, that's all we know, really, isn't it?
Yeah,
like how we can relate stuff.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, definitely. I think London is as. I lived in London for 10 years and I loved it. I felt like at the end of it, I needed to leave. You know, Berlin was calling and stuff. But I feel like it's like a marriage and there was a divorce, but now we're talking again. You know, we're having Sundays together and stuff.
Yeah. You know, it's not very cool to say London nowadays, is it? You know, it's when where do you live, London? You know, it's. But London has this tendency to regrow itself, and you know, and I can see it happening now. You know,
yeah.
I mean, Fold. You know, as I'm speaking on in, you know, kind of music terms and whatnot. You know, Fold is emerging. The Glove That Fits, and the White. It's not Manchester. It's not London, but you know, the White Hotel in Manchester. It's like, okay, England's sprouting again, you know.
Yeah.
Of course, politically, it's all a bit of a mess and Brexit and everything else. But yeah, you know, like yourself, probably I just watch what's happening on the underground circuits usually.
And yeah.
It seems to be sprouting.
It is very, very, yeah, definitely. There's a lot of, I mean, that's it. It's just like, you know, we always seem like see ourselves sometimes in the timeline that we're in rather than sort of thinking like timelines just come and go all of the time.
Don't yeah, they? Yeah,
they
yeah.
They regenerate or they move somewhere else or they come back, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Richie, thank you very much.
No worries. Thank you very much.
Cool. Cheers. Thank you.
Nice.
Okay, so that was me, Paul Hanford, meeting Richie Culver for Lost and Sound podcast. And we had that conversation today. If you're listening to the podcast the day it comes out, the conversation also happened today, which is the 30th of May 2023. I hope you are all having a lovely, lovely, lovely day or evening or morning or whenever you're listening to this. Richie's remix album, I Was Born by the Sea, the remixes, is out on Participant Records on 23rd of June 2023. Thank you so much, Richie, for your time this afternoon. And thank you also to the people at Tailored Communication for sorting that out. Lost and Sound is produced and everything like that by me, Paul Hanford. My book, Coming to Berlin, is available now in bookshops and online via Velocity Press. And Lost and Sound is proudly sponsored by Audio Technica. Audio Technica, a global but still family-run company that make headphones, turntables, cartridges, microphones, studio quality yet affordable products, because they believe that high-quality audio should be accessible to all. So wherever you are in the world, head on over to audiotechnica.com to check out all of their range of stuff. What else? Oh, yes. ESO does the music that you hear at the beginning, at the end of every episode. Go to ESO's Instagram page, which I always hyperlink, to check out more music made by ESO. It is really nice actually here. I'm stood in Hassenheide Park, which is sort of between Kreuzberg and Neukölln in Berlin, if you're not familiar with the area. And I'm in a little bit where sitting quite a little way away from me up a hill, there's some people playing some instruments. A little bit further away, there's the nudist side of the park, where you usually see like an old man walking around with a newspaper, flip-flops and nothing else. And then that's kind of what it is, isn't it? That's what it's all about. I hope you're having a really, really fucking amazing day, and I'll chat to you soon.